Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record indicate that it is 1:35 p.m. on Wednesday, March 25th, 2015. Present today, we have Co-Chair Newman, Vice Chair Sadler, Representative Gaddis, Representative Munoz, Representative Pruitt, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Kawasaki, and myself, Representative Thompson, and Representative Wilson. Before we start, please turn off your cell phones. They interfere with the recording equipment. On today's schedule, we'll have our first hearing of two bills, House Bill 41 and House Bill 158. I do not intend to move either one of these bills out of committee today. Our first order of business is House Bill 41, an act relating to sport fishing services, sport fishing operators, and sport fishing guides, and providing for an effective date by Representative Tilton and Munoz. Here to present out HB 41 is Representative Tilton and her staff, Heath Hilliard, and Representative Munoz with her staff, Crystal Koneman. Please come to the table, put yourselves on the record, and begin your presentation.
Thank you,
Well, your mic down a little bit, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Thompson, for hearing our bill today and the rest of the committee. HB 41 reestablishes a sport fishing guide and operator licensure, which was sunsetted on December 31st of 2014. Reestablishing the license for recreational fishing guides, it amends a previously existing fee structure to bring that structure to a more budget-neutral structure. The 2014 sunset wasn't intentional. It was an unintentional oversight that arose from a failure to act on another piece of legislation. So the intent of the sponsors to reestablish the license that have benefited the guiding sport industry and the general public. If you have any questions, I have Heath Hilliard here with me from my staff who can answer any policy questions, and Crystal Koneman can answer any questions on the financing.
Okay, questions, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome for the first time, Representative Tilton.
Thank Representative you. Tilton. Thank you, Representative Newman. To the chair.
Kathy, we had brought an issue to you about the license fees for a little bit of discussion, just for referral to the committee. Could you discuss kind of what we went over on the cost for the license fees and why?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, Co-Chair Newman, yes. In the bill that's before you, we had a stepped-up fee process that would start with the $100 fee and add $50 a year until it got to a double of $200 a year. It would have left the board in a deficit position for the first 2 years and then in a positive position, and it would have paid for itself over time. I did have a discussion with Co-Chair Newman and his staff and have talked about going from the stepped-up fee increase just to directly to the increase from $100 to the $200 fee, being the time that we're in this fiscal time in our state, and looking at all the boards and where they're at and trying to get boards back to where they are, but they are paying for themselves, I believe that it's a prudent thing to do.
Representative Newman.
Yeah, basically what we found is it would have left a $251 million deficit in the first 2 years. And this board's willing to pay and cover their costs, which I appreciate your effort in working with them to do that. So instead of having the state having to come back and subsidize that, Representative Tilton volunteered to work with us to do a CS that would correct that so that it would not be left in a deficit.
Yes.
Nope. Additional questions from the committee? Representative Gaddis.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have talked with the bill sponsor, and I was there are a few questions that I was waiting to speak to her staff. So maybe if he could come forward.
Mr. Hilliard, place yourself on the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Heath Hilliard. I'm staff to Representative Tilton.
Go ahead, Representative Gaddis.
Thank you. And, Mr. Hilliard, I guess here was my challenge that I spoke to your boss, Representative Tilton, and I said one of the things that was missing were any comments from the MATSU. So can you tell me, does this specifically deal with the MATSU? I see where it talks about the Kenai River, but I really wanted to see how it does or doesn't engage in the MATSU.
Through the co-chair, Representative Gaddis, one of the provisions or the provision you see in this bill with regard to the Kenai River the special guide use area, that actually was in statute until December 31st, 2014. So that's not anything new that we're adding. That was in the pre-existing statutory structure. With regard to how it interplays with the MATSU, we simply in HB 41 reestablished the licensure as it existed previous, and it's not specifically directed toward the MATSU. The bottom line is if you're a sport fish operator anywhere in the state, you have to have this licensure, or at least you did under the existing statute. So it doesn't in any way target the MATSU or put them in any sort of bind that is not relevant to anywhere else in the state. Does that answer your question, Madam?
Follow up, Representative Gaddis.
Thank
I can
you.
See you.
and I'm sorry, you know, we just, today we might have been able to do this earlier, and it's great because I do have some MATSU folks listening online, and I indicated that it was been my experience that we don't usually move the bill the first time around. So a lot of the MATSU people, this will be their first experience for listening to it. So, and I just became real familiar with it here in the last couple of hours. So it may be a good thing. Maybe, you know, we'll see where we go with that. So I have a bunch of questions. That being said, this is for freshwater, this is for ocean, this is for federal waters, and this is for state waters. Is that correct?
Through the co-chair, Representative Gaddis, in essence, yes. If you provide guided fishing services for compensation in the state of Alaska, you have to have this license regardless of where you do it.
Okay. Thank you. And I guess that makes sense. And just the Kenai River special management area that you've indicated here is part and parcel of what was in the bill. Does this also cover folks that are in power boats, rafting boats? Again, circle back around. It's really about the guiding license and less about where it is, correct? Somewhere in the state.
Through the co-chair, Representative Gaddis, that's correct. If you're not providing guided fishing services, you can do whatever you want. There's not a licensure requirement. If you have your own personal pleasure boat that you do some fishing off of, but you don't receive compensation for guiding clients, then you don't have to have the license. So it's are you actively engaged in guiding clients for fish?
And one more question, if you might, and I think I'll be done.
All right, ahead, Representative Gaddis.
Thank you. And when speaking to the folks in the MATSU, some of the charter folks, what they indicated, and I just wanted to put it on record, that in their logbook and how they've done in the past, and they hadn't seen this bill yet, so they're listening right now, but what they indicated is that they understood that reporting in the logbooks and that they really liked that aspect if we're gathering data, but let's gather good data. So more importantly, it was about what species and so on and so forth. And in the past, they just said how many fish. So they really want, if they're going to gather data, let's go for the best data that we can. Of course, for those that are not aware, in the MATSU, we're certainly always looking for more fish and better ways to gather data. So thank you.
I wanted to point out to the committee also, we have representatives from Fish and Game and the Department of Natural Resources if we have additional questions. Representative Newman. Representative Guttenberg is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out that I sent a note to the person whose phone went off with my preference for donuts, so anybody else is welcome.
Well, I was going to thank Cliff Stone for buying us donuts for tomorrow because his phone went off. Thank you very much. Representative Newman.
Thank you. Maybe we should thank Representative Guttenberg. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Heath, does this bill do anything? I don't think this bill has. Does this bill have anything to do with the logbooks?
Through the co-chair Newman, I guess the response would be sort of indirectly, in that if you provide guided fishing services, you have to maintain a logbook. And I believe that the representatives from the Department of Fish and Game can answer it a little bit more correctly. That The guidebook provisions are actually in regulation. This bill simply reestablishes the licensure that went away accidentally on December 31st. But it's an interrelated, but this bill does not direct that specifically.
Mr. Chair,
would you like to have Fish and Game come up and?
Well, that's how I remember it. I worked on the on the logbook thing for a while and chewed on a department for a while for a few years on that. But, Mr. Chair, I do have another question. Mr. Hilliard, you mentioned the special management, Kenai special management area, and I'm trying to remember back with some discussions that I've had with guides in that, where in here, as you say, a guide, a sport fishing operator, can also have the people who work under them work under his license. But if a guy breaks a leg for whatever comes and can't be his guide, seems to me that there was some issues about being having the ability to bring in a new guide to work under that. Are you familiar with any of those issues?
Through the co-chair, Co-Chair Newman, you're correct. The Kenai special use area is administered by the Department of Natural Resources. So in addition to having the general sport fish operator and guide license to operate in areas of the Kenai River, you also have to have an additional permit issued under, I believe it's DNR, with regard to that. And what that provision, that carve-out provision is, in the event that a Kenai River guide has an assistant guide who is sick or injured or for whatever reason departs and has done the training to have the necessary permit, they have a waiver for the remainder of the season to allow them to hire someone else who has not done the training, doesn't have the permit, simply because the Guide Academy, as it pertains to the Kenai River, that special use, it only happens periodically throughout the year. Now, I do know that there has been some discussion about trying to make that an electronic training program so that it can be done at any point in time. But at this point in time, it doesn't exist. I know that that's under consideration, but that's how that whole permit and special use area relates to this bill. So you have to have the sport fish license, but if you're guiding on a Kenai, you have additional requirements.
Thank you. I just wanted to make for clarification on people who are concerned about that. Thank you, Mr. Hilliard. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Next, we have Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple questions for the sponsor, whoever wants to answer on the sport fish guide licensing. I know that in typical times we've had the sunset on it, because I know it's come before the Resources Committee at least twice. Is there a reason why there isn't a sunset date in this?
Through the co-chair, Representative Kawasaki, there actually is a sunset. The master sunset would be found on page 10, line 28, section 15. But the way this current bill is structured, presuming that we have a graduated fee increase schedule, you'll see multiple sunset dates or effective dates depending upon which section. But the master section really would be, the sunset would be January 1, 2026 for the overall licensure components.
That's a long time. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
That's a kind of a long time for a typical sunset of a program or agency. Another question dealing with this guide, sport fish guide, registration in general. And typically, we've seen at least one or two boards come through this. The Midwives Board came through a couple weeks ago. Typically, when there's a board issue, they have there's a board, and it's governor appointed, legislative confirmation, and the idea is that they provide input in what's going on within their own realm of expertise. Has there been any thought to try to create a board specifically so that they could manage their own affairs?
Through the co-chair, Representative Kawasaki, that's actually exactly why we have this bill before us. This licensure provision was actually in several pieces of legislation in the past that was attempting to establish a charter fishing guide board. I will say that in my previous capacity representing the Southeast Sport Fleet, I testified on that and testified in support of a general board concept, believing that there could be some value. However, again, what happened in the last legislature, in the 28th legislature, is this licensure renewal was in that bill, and the bill did not move, and so the licensure went away. So The short answer is yes, it's been considered. The reason that it did not move is because, generally speaking, amongst the charter fishing community, there's been a lot of pushback by the industry for a board.
Yes.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I may, this is Crystal Kieneman, staff to Representative Munoz. Another piece as to why the board issue wasn't as favorable to some as others. The cost associated with a board was fairly high, and so those costs would be then passed on to the operators, and so trying to get support from that was hard to come by. I know my experience when I was over at Commerce, when this idea had come up to regulate a board, the costs were pretty astronomical. I mean, some of the things that they were looking for in that board just raised the costs up too high for the average charter guide to support.
And so follow-up, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Through the chair. So then currently, I guess the situation that exists here is that the Department of Fish and Game would sort of be the regulators out of this process? There.
Representative Kawasaki, through the co-chair, yes, you know, it's...
I got two more, one on the fiscal note and then one on the, in general. The sport fishing guide requirements, according to Fish and Game in the overview, require that a person who's a sport fish business owner have a business license, mm-hmm. and they have a code for business for a person who does sport fish. That's through Department of Commerce. Then they also have to have this license through Fish and Game. They have to have a sport fish guide registration issued. They have to have their own sport fish license and all the tags that are associated with the fishery in which they're in. They have to have a current, according to federal government, U.S. Coast Guard operator's license, the six-pack. And then their vessel also has to be registered. I'm just curious, as we add some requirements. I mean, these are right now. If we do nothing, there's nothing there, right? And we're adding something back to the way it was prior to 2015 or 14. How much do you think that costs? If I just wanted to start my own business, I've got a boat. I want to start guiding on the Some River. Is it prohibitive for a person that wants to just go out there, make a living as a guide, to become a licensed guide?
Through the co-chair, Representative Kawasaki, maybe I can speak to that a little bit more clearly. First of all, it really depends on if you're fishing exclusively freshwater or saltwater, state managed species or federally managed species. The cost in the circumstance of, for instance, southeast saltwater with halibut, which is a federally managed species, there is a moratorium permit program in place called the Charter Halibut Permit, which you can, if you were not one of the original, if you did not receive one of the original permits under that program, you can lease or purchase from someone who does, and the cost can be quite sizable. My point is that it can vary greatly depending upon where you're guiding for what species you are generally fishing. In putting this bill forward, we spoke with a number of the charter groups throughout the state who have said they believe the licensure is valuable and that they were willing to pay up to double to make sure that they maintain that licensure. Now, it's entirely likely we will hear some different things from different regions, but we reached out to a couple of the key statewide charter groups who said we believe it's necessary and we're willing to pay more for it.
Follow up. Yeah, this is like current charter operators, though, and what I fear is that we price people out of the market. Person just wants to go out there. They want to become a guide. They have to follow a lot of regulations and rules. They have to have a license. They have to have a seemingly redundant license now under this legislation. And, we haven't heard from the people who are saying, I would really like to be a sport guide. This is the thing that prohibits me from doing so. So I guess that's just a – and then on the fiscal note, I had a question.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The fiscal note from Fish and Game discusses the positions that are required under reinstatement under House Bill 41. There's a full-time office assistant, 11-month, a full-time Fish and Game program tech, 12 months, one full-time office assistant, two for half the year, 6 months, two full-time office assistants for 7 months, and one full-time coordinator for 6 months. The total cost in this fiscal year would be $383,000. And I see that you've raised the license fees accordingly to try and capture that amount. I'm just curious why there needs to be five people administering this one program.
Representative Kawasaki, through the co-chair, these are positions that are currently there at Fish and Game. These aren't new positions. I just wanted to make sure that the committee was aware. And due to the seasonal aspect of this, that's why you'll see some as part-time, you know, seasonally. I think Fish and Game may be able to answer a little bit better as to the need for all five of them, but that's what they're currently operating, and they feel that, those are the demands that they need.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kawasaki. Next, we have Representative Guerra, then you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at the definitions, and I don't see a definition of sport fishing vessel. And maybe I'm just missing it, but I just want to make 100% clear, a sport fishing vessel doesn't include a recreational raft or vessel that somebody uses where they're not earning compensation for fishing.
Through the co-chair, Representative Guerra, the issue is, are you guiding people for compensation? And if the answer is yes, then whatever vessel you're doing that from would be considered a sport fishing vessel. If you're not receiving compensation for guiding people to fish, then you're not a sport fish operator or guide, so you wouldn't need to license your vessel as such.
Follow up, Representative Guerra.
Yeah, through the chair, I'm somewhat confident that that's the answer, but I just don't see anything that says a sport fishing vessel is something that is a vessel run by somebody who makes compensation for it. So I just want to make 100% clear, or 100% sure, that we're not going to reinstate what was a very controversial program a number of years ago, where they were making people who were not fishing for compensation register their boats.
Representative Guerra, through the co-chair, if you look at the top of page 7, it's a carryover from the definition of sport fishing services in sub 3. It does say that sport fishing services does not include an activity for which sport fishing guide license is required, or booking, you know, ancillary services provided by broker agent. I don't know if that helps answer your question or not, but sub 3 does explain really what sport fishing services are.
Through the chair.
Go ahead.
Okay, so it is a vessel is only a vessel that is used for sport fishing services, so that helps. And where does it say sport fishing services are only those services where you get compensation?
Representative Guerra, through the co-chair, sub 3, page 6, line 29, it says sport fishing services means the indirect provision of assistance for compensation or with the intent to receive compensation to a person engaged in sport fishing and taking or attempting to take fish or shellfish by a business that employs a sport fishing guide.
Thank you. I think that helps a lot. And...
Follow-up, Representative Guerra.
And I guess I would just ask for your guarantee that there's nothing in this bill that would require non-motorized boats to register. That was a very controversial program a number of years ago.
Representative Guerra, through the co-chair, if they're providing compensation in a non-motorized boat, I believe they would have to, but if they're not providing a service for compensation, it is my understanding that they would not have to register their vessel.
All right. Thanks.
Okay. Next we have Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the sponsor or to staff, I'm not sure. On page 10, line 28, which is section 15 of the bill, I'm cautious about asking this question because the answer might be really clear in front of me. I'm not seeing it. But what are the sections 5, 9, and 10 take effect in 2026? My reading is the section 5 requires a guide to register a boat. Section 9 requires the commissioner to write regulations. and Section 10 is a lot of repealers. Help me understand why these provisions don't take effect until 2026.
Through the co-chair, Representative Sadler, both Ms. Keeneman and I were originally confused about that. That's an effect of drafting. The drafter explained to us that essentially 5, 9, and 10, that is when the licensure is then repealed. So we put in the licensure presuming this bill passes, we put in the licensure that January 1, 2016, and then the effect of Section 15 means that's when the repealers go into effect. We were very confused by that as well. But okay. it's a drafting.
Double negative kind of. Yeah. This is when something affirmatively does not happen. Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Pruitt's next.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So a couple questions. The first one, we'll start with Mr. Hilliard. I see that Section 6 is mostly really the program, and it says that we're adding that. Can you confirm for me that basically that was removed when it sunsetted, and so we're just adding that back in. If you can confirm that, and then second, is there anything new that we are adding from what was in the program before that's now in this new program?
Through the co-chair, Representative Pruitt, our directions to drafting were put back in place exactly what previously existed, the only difference being the graduated fee structure to double it over the course of 3 years. That is the only difference. And then, of course, obviously, the effective dates address are adjusted accordingly. Okay. There is no other policy provision that is different from what was previously existing.
Yeah, and I wanted to confirm that. Didn't want to make the assumption. The second question that I have relates to the fee structure, and I'll move to Ms. Kinnaman for that, as you were supposed to. You're the financial guru on this at this point. So for state parks, one of the things that we've done for them is we've given the director a little bit of authority so that we basically have put a ceiling on certain fees and given him the authority to move fees a little bit as appropriate. Here, we're appropriately, I think you guys have done what you need to do to fill the gap so that we're not having the general fund fill where it misses. But one of the things that I've noticed on the fiscal note, and this is separate from you guys, this is probably something that we need to address with the administration, is there's no way that we're going to have 6 full-time positions that are never going to see an increase over the course of the next 6 years. So with that being said, as you guys have had that graduated step to make sure that we're covering the costs and recognizing that there will probably be increases to the program where it will not stay at $382,000 for the next 6 years, would you be amenable to a conversation related to after the time frame that you've set in place to get us to that the two steps up, where we establish some sort of a ceiling so that we didn't have to come back again in 3 or 4 years to maybe increase the fees to cover now what could potentially be costing us more than the fiscal note initially established. So, and I don't want to say what the number would be, but some number that says that gives the director or gives the commissioner the ability to move appropriately to cover the costs of the program if in turn the costs do increase.
Representative Pruitt, through the co-chair, that was one of the things that I looked at, you know, with my experience over at Commerce and the licensing of the programs. It is very frustrating when you see licensing programs run into a deficit position. So one of the things that in looking at this and setting these fees that I looked at was projecting out the 10 years and figuring out if there would be enough carry forward balance by this increase in revenue to get us at least to the sunset, which is 10 years from now. So from my analysis and talking with the department and figuring out other cost-saving measures that they could take, the hope is that they can make it through those 10 years with these fees in place. Then when this program comes up again for sunset, that if fees need to be reevaluated at that time, they could look at them again. I understand your point with giving the commissioner flexibility. I don't see that being a bad thing, but I know for the licensing community, giving them stability to know what those fees are for their businesses year by year tends to help in their business decisions. So that is a policy call if you want to do the ceiling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's one of the things that I think we found works with state parks is we didn't have to go through and run a bill through the legislature to allow the state parks to go from a 33% covering of the costs of state parks being run by in their fees. They've moved from 33% to 44%. They're going to move up to 50%. But we didn't have to run a bill through the legislature and jump through those hoops. And it just might be something just recognizing that there doesn't show that there is an increase, but we all know that there are increases, not to be extravagant in any way, shape, or form, but just prevent the having to go through the legislative process by here in maybe 4 or 5 years if that was necessary. It might just be something to think about, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt. Next, we have Representative Newman, followed by Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pruitt, on that point, we did work with the sponsor, and my staff worked out a fee schedule on that, where it looks at that, and actually all the way out through 10 years, they will have a surplus deficit to cover the cost of increased costs for each year, as we know is going to happen. It's just the world gets more expensive every year. So that was included in there. So the combined program balance all the way up to FY16 would end up with about a $5,000 surplus at the end, plus cover all their costs, or at the FY26, plus cover all their cost increases throughout that time.
Thank you, Co-Chair Newman. Next, we have another question, Representative Newman.
I just want to make sure we responded to that, make sure that we covered that with the sponsor, Representative Tilton. Mr. Hilliard, help me on this one. With the sport fishing vessel, and Representative Dare's question reminded me of this. So you've got a guide, sport fishing guide. He has his boat. You have to have the sticker on the boat identifying that it's a sport fishing vessel. And he's got a licensed vessel. But he can't put his family in there and go fishing. He has to go buy a whole other boat to go do that. Is that my understanding?
Co-Chair Newman, I don't believe that's correct. It's simply a matter of whether or not they're using that boat and being compensated at the time. So a charter captain, for instance, as long as it's a non-revenue trip, he's taking his family and friends out, there's no compensation being exchanged, he can use his charter boat.
I don't think that that's true. I know in the Kenai River district that they cannot use those, and maybe we can ask the department on that, Mr. Chair.
If we could have the department come up, we'd sure appreciate it. Yes, place yourself on the record.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom Brookover, the Acting Director for Division of Sport Fish with the department. Through the chair, as far as the fish and game requirements go, this doesn't speak to potentially other requirements like the DNR requirements in the Kenai River, but as far as the fish and game requirements go, vessels that are registered and have the decal for enabling the use in guided fishing can be used for private purposes, again, and Mr. Hilliard had it correct, as long as it's not being used for compensation. If it's being taken out for private purposes, no compensation involved by either just the operator or family members or so forth. If it's just a fishing trip for fun, no fees involved. No services provided. It can be used, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair,
follow up.
Even in the Kenai special use area?
Mr. Chair, I would look to Department of Natural Resources for that. I'm not familiar with that.
We have the Director of Parks here, Mr. Chair.
Can we have DNR please come up? Yes, place yourself on the record.
For the record, my name is Ben Ellis. I'm the director of the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. Talking about the Kenai River Special Management Area, there is a DNR regulation that prohibits a guide from using a guide boat on, say, a Sunday when there's no guided fishing. So in that case, in other words, there's no guided fishing on the Kenai River on Sundays. And so on those days, if a guide wanted to do personal fishing on a Sunday, they would have to use a non registered guide boat to do that. I believe it's the only place in the state we have that.
Hmm. So just for clarification, Mr. Chair, so even in the Kenai special use area, if it's a day other than Sunday, if a guide takes his clients out for the day, wants to take his family out fishing, he can use that licensed guide boat?
Yes, sir.
Okay, we heard it here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Ellis. Next, we have Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So maybe this goes along with it because, and mine is probably more about federal and halibut, but on their but on their charters, can someone who is a sport fishing guide be able to have a family out and catch any number of halibuts they want because they're not doing a guided service?
Through the chair, Representative, that's a good question, and I'm not sure about that with respect to the federal requirements.
And I have a follow-up, sir.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
So we're talking a lot about compensation. So let's take, say I take family, friends out. I haven't provided anything. They brought their own food, whatever they want to bring with them. And they had such a great time. At the end of the day, they give me $1,000 because they're really rich friends.
Yeah.
Does that count as compensation because I haven't required any of it? Or what would that count as? And, of course, I'm going for halibut, too.
Through the chair, Representative. So there is a definition of compensation. I was just looking through the bill to find it. I'm not sure if it's in the bill, but the Board of Fish has defined compensation. And in that case, the definition of compensation allows for some small reimbursement of reasonable expenses for fuel, for example, and the definition lines out specific items. There's relatively few of them. I think in the case of $1,000, that would be well in excess of fuel or inconsequential food costs and the other items outlined in that definition, and that would be considered compensation.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
If you could get that definition, I'd appreciate it. I guess the bigger story, and I don't know whether this is the vehicle for that or not, but I received a call a couple of days ago from one of my constituents who chartered down in Valdez. And again, we're back to that committee out there that's made up of Canadian and U.S. officials requiring less food. Now you can get less fish even if you are chartering versus if I have my own boat. And so I don't know whether, it has any impact here, but we're almost driving people more to figuring what that compensation is and taking them out themselves versus everything that's required here. And back to what Representative Kawasaki was saying and all the additional fees, I guess where is that point finally where somebody says, I would rather, because a lot of this is for safety, making sure you're bonded, making sure you have all the classes. But if we get to that point where it's too much and I can take my boat and take them out, every day but Sunday, depending on where I am, and get enough compensation to make it more worth my while, how do we figure out if that's where we get on things like this?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Wilson, if I could attempt to at least address part of your point. I'm assuming when you talk about one of your constituents, you're probably either talking about Mr. Bookie or Mr. Larson. In my previous capacity representing sport fishing throughout, particularly Southeast, you're bringing up some very legitimate questions, particularly in the disparity between guided and unguided for halibut. In Southeast Alaska, I believe the 2015 regulation is for guided. It's one fish per day under 42 inches and over 76 inches. And as we've dealt with that on a resident, non-resident basis, more of the guided recreational anglers in Southeast tend to be non-residents. This is more problematic, obviously, in South Central, where a number of interior residents, for instance, will go down and fish out of either Seward or Homer for halibut. That's where they do it. The long and the short of it is, when I previously represented the recreational sector on the advisory panel for the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, the compensation issue and the people circumventing the existing licensure was obviously something we considered and worked on pretty diligently. The short answer is, without consistent enforcement, it's sometimes really difficult to wrap your arms around that completely. So I guess there's not a specific answer, but to say it's obviously an issue that's been confronting the guided recreational industry that they have been attempting to address for a number of years.
And Mr. Chair, I guess my question, or my concern more is, and I understand that and I appreciate it, but what they may be doing is not necessarily illegal. I mean, if we have what compensation is and isn't, they still may be legal going around what I think the intent of the state is to do. And that's really why I wanted just to bring those ideas, you know, forward, because I think we really are at that breaking point. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Next, we have Representative Gaddis.
Okay, I didn't realize it. Well, I was going to bring up the same compensation aspect, I guess. In aviation, I don't have a commercial license, but rather a private license, and I can take my friends with me, and they can split fuel, and that's not considered compensation. So you really did answer that question, and I assumed that, and one should never do that, but that that would be the same thing in regards to compensation in this case, that you could split fuel and you could split expenses. And that's not really compensation. So at the end of the day, if I take a trip that costs me, well, nothing costs less than $100 in fuel, but $100 in fuel, and somebody gave me $1,000, well, clearly that's compensation. So, but you could split the expenses, correct?
Through the chair, Representative, that's correct. And this was recently brought up to the Board of Fisheries, I think, within the last year or two, because of the subjectivity of where that line is, and we had staff and Fish and Wildlife Protection staff and board members and Department of Law scrutinize that regulation so that it did draw as bright a line as possible between what is compensation and what's not considered compensation, and made that clear to members of the public, you know, both guides and individuals, private citizens. Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the interest of splitting hairs and trying to get a better definition of what is, I've been waiting and hoping that I didn't have to ask this, but it hasn't come up, so I will. A whitewater guide or a wilderness kayaking guide takes a group of people out. He's got all the appropriate insurance, appropriate licensing, everything's, but he might, there might be fishing opportunities. He's not guiding it. They camp for the night. Somebody walks downriver, upriver, pulls out their fly rod and fishes. Is that covered in a fly fishing fishing guides? It's not his primary purpose. It's not even something he does. We're in for the night. Somebody decides to go fishing. Is he part of this? Or she?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are probably a number of examples that would be more and even less clear in terms of the associated aspect of the activity that that person's doing and how closely related it is to the services being provided. And I think some of those cases are going to need to be determined on a case-by-case basis, looking at the specifics in the definition of sport fishing guide services. I would have to ask somebody from the Alaska Wildlife Troopers probably how they would view that. I think we would have to have staff look at that specific case. And in those cases, we try to work directly with businesses and guides to discern whether it falls on the side of being a fishing guide service or whether it does not. I think in that case, it's going to depend on whether fishing guide services were provided as they are defined in the definition.
Okay, so for follow-up. If it was part of the service that was that fishing was provided, as compared with somebody bringing their own gear, that would be a defining?
Through the chair, Representative, yes, that is the case. And we do have businesses that provide services other than fishing. They may provide recreational hiking experiences as well as fishing here in Southeast and other locations that is common. But in those cases where they are providing fishing services, they're required to get a license under this scenario.
All right. Is there any further questions? Seeing none, I want to thank you all for being up here at the table. At this time, I'd like to give Mr. Paul Johnson a chance to get public testimony on this bill. Mr. Johnson is in Juneau today, and therefore I'd like to extend the courtesy to him to testify on this bill. Mr. Johnson, if you'd please come up, place yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Johnson. I've been in this business over 40 years. Mrs. Wilson, yeah, we're at the tipping point. In fact, bare boats this last year took more resource than did charter boats. every single federal agent out there that stops me, that includes Coast Guard, NOAA, National Park Service, and state troopers, all have a different opinion on this rule. It's embarrassing when they come on board. I'm all for stewardship. Have been. My family's been here for generations, and we have supported and worked towards having future fish for our children. This bill does not do that. I understand reporting requirements on those things that are necessary. This is a saltwater logbook program. This is the fresh. This is so complex that when a federal agent boards your boat, any little slight error on here, you get a ticket. Any day that you're 2 days late on getting one of these, I give it to the tax cab driver in Gustavus, and it's 2 days late, it's strict liability. You get a ticket. This bill is so complex and has so many pieces to the puzzle that even when you get a ticket and then you apply for a Glacier Bay prospectus bid and you have one ticket, you don't get that bid. As far as people that you're shoving out, you're pushing them over into bareboat, and it's becoming a huge industry. We're giving our resources away in the state for 10 cents on the dollar. My suggestion is that you hold on to this. You put a group of people together, not just the fishing organizations out there. Most of those are non-residents. In Juneau, it's not necessarily, but I can tell you in my area, there's two of us that are residents, and we have huge, I'm a mom-and-pop little place. I have four logbooks a day to fill out. My clients have to not only put down their fishing license number, print out their name, and sign it every day. And what is this serving? What's it accomplishing? We have Creel census in every single one of those communities. We have Creel census in Gustavus, Dolphin Cove, Pelican. Yes, our resource is precious, extremely precious, and let's work towards that. We're asking for statistical numbers. I bought millions of pounds of fish out in this country. We had 14A, 14B, 14C. We have six digits on this one, filling up the computers. It needs to be cleaned up. Whenever you give a division, and this new gentleman here, I just met him. I've talked to Charlie Swanton, I've talked to Dora Sweeney on all of this, and just kind of throw up their hands. So, Coast Guard comes. I'm going to get that all quit. Coast Guard comes. I'm going to back up just a little bit. Our small communities in the southeast are dying. When I was a kid, there were 60 seine boats in Hoonah. We have one left. The last gentleman just passed away a couple days ago. Be very careful what you do. This has been for 10 years. I lived with it for 10 years. A sunset is very, very important. There was not an audit done on this like there is on most of the boards. This was just thrown back in here. Take some time. It's not going to die tomorrow. I have my new logbooks. You'll get the information. Nothing's going to die this year. All of us, like the people in the valley, want to give good information. It could be done electronically easy. But I'm going to give you an example. Coast Guard comes on board. You've got two guys with 9mm Glocks, and you've got a graf going around you with M16s. Sometimes I get boarded four times a day. Now, I'm a small operator. I have a hard time getting my customers to come. Well, he comes on board, and I make a mistake. I put down 7 on the month of June instead of a 6. You sign a deal on the bottom that says you're basically going to go to jail if everything above here is not true and correct. Okay? So that agent comes, that guy comes on board. He says, this is last year's. I said, no, it's this year's. And I realized what I had done. He goes out in the back deck. 45 minutes later, after talking to the cutter, he comes back in and says, goodness, you've signed that. And I changed him in the meantime to 6 and tried to make light of it. No, there was no making light of it. These people are from Maine, they're from New Jersey. The Park Service are brought in 2 weeks before. They each think that there's a requirement, since you have a requirement in here, that I have to have a picture ID, a driver's license, something. So they immediately interpret that all my customers do. Well, my customers, they're not going to take their personal ID with them. That's the only way they can get on a jet to get back home. If I lost it out on the boat or walking up the stream, they're done. So they sit there and they argue with me back and forth, and you're not going to argue with these people back and forth in front of your customers. Why do I need my ID? I can vote with my fishing license, for God's sakes. Anyway, long and short of it is be very careful continuing this program as is without a lot of thought being put into it. We went through this in the big game guiding industry, just like you said, Mrs. Wilson, Representative Wilson. We started pushing out, and we ended up having a huge group of outfitters. Henry Springer, I sat on that task force that grouped things back together. Same thing as the bear boat, same thing as this. I'm long in the tooth here. I'm not going to be around much longer. But I do want something that's an economic opportunity for the next generation that is, let's get the things we need. Requiring these Coast Guard licenses, let the Coast Guard take that. The insurance requirements and all those other things that somebody in a rural area can't possibly match, can't possibly get into. Anyway, my request is, there's a lot to this. It's not simple. It's not easy. I am a fishing guy. I brought these books today so somebody could at least see what they're like. I don't mind paying if we get good information for what we need. I don't mind reporting if we get information on what we need. But we're going way, way beyond that with this program. And, yeah, we're creating some jobs in Anchorage, but I'm ready to go off the edge. And that's no kidding.
Questions, Mr. Johnson, Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for coming forward. And I've known your family for many years. I believe my grandfather and your father were business partners in the fishing business. Could you explain for the record the term bare boats?
Bare boat is where somebody can come up. Most of the bare boats in our area are owned out of people out of state. They have people come up, don't charge nearly as much as I do, so of course we lose economy out of that. But they have GPSs on them that have all the set locations of where people go fishing. And at this point, they're being told that they can't have what's called a chase boat around them. But long and short of it is, they go out there and they don't have to fill out a single one of these. They don't have to do any of this stuff. They don't have to show Coast Guard. Nothing. Nothing. And I'm not asking to burden those people either. But when you be careful when you push a cork down here, it pops up over here. I've been in the wildlife business my whole life and been involved in it. So a bare boat, basically, you're taking the boat. These people are cleaning all your fish. They're packaging it up. People walk out with 9-10 boxes of fish and go home and pay a little bit. The guy that owns those, he goes back to Utah or back to Washington, and he doesn't even hear what's going on here today. Doesn't have a clue. Most of the guys out there don't have a clue other than they belong to a charter organization like Seago. Seago, all the guys out at Elfin Cove, I don't know how many lodges there are, 6, 7, they're all members of Seago. And the more they can create this to keep other people out of business, the more excited they are. We've got quotas on all this, halibut, and the only quota in Southeast is in King Salmon. Have we met the quotas? Have we got a problem? No. But one size doesn't fit all throughout the state, through the interior. In our guide licensing program, I sat on that board for a long time. We never asked for Coast Guard licenses for our guys because up in the navigable waters in the interior, it's almost impossible to sort out. The Coast Guard can't sort it out themselves. And like the fish and game, or the fish and game director here just said, when an officer comes up and interprets it his own way, if he can't answer it, I can guarantee you each civil officer is going to answer it differently. This needs to be clean, straightforward, and overall covering. I know it's going to take some time to do this. I know you're going to have to bring in the bare boat people and the other people and put a group together, but it's worth waiting a year for. I promise you that. If you want to have business in Alaska. Otherwise, when I sell my place, it's probably going to go to a non-resident. There'll be no economy out of it all.
Representative Pruitt has a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. I appreciate your it's good to have someone in here to viewpoint. I know we'll hear from others as well later on. I had two questions, and one actually stems from that. I still didn't fully understand why do the bare boats that you referred to, and that was a term that was new to me.
Right.
Why do they not have to fill out any of this
stuff? You don't make any requirements to them.
But I'm trying to figure out how there's people that why does it apply to you, and why does it not apply to
they don't
to
have
someone
an active fish guide on board that's taking the fish off their hooks or whatever.
Got it. Thank you. That's I understand that.
And
now,
once you exclude that, you may send your helper along from the fish cleaning dock.
Got it.
But enforcement there, basically. So the bottom line is they catch twice as much in Southeast as the charter boats do.
Okay.
That was what was told earlier today. I don't really know the figures.
The second question is how much of what you're referring to, and there's some crossover between federal and state. What you're referring to, I want to make sure that what we're addressing here is, of course, what we have the control over, which is the state aspect of
right.
it. And unfortunately, I think you'd probably find, I wouldn't say it's unanimous, but a lot of people that agree with you with your challenges with the Coast Guard and some of these other federal agencies, because you're not the only one that they're encroaching on. Help me understand that what this program does at the state piece to inhibit your business, separate from the federal side, what does this do that inhibits your ability to do what you need to do?
Okay. This is a federal state book.
Okay.
We're doing it for the feds. Okay? And the reason that was done was so there would be less information for somebody to fill out. So you have, for instance, a CHIP permit, a GAF permit, two different things. One's off IFQs. One is just that you get the license to catch fish. Okay? That's in here. I also have to report electronically to the feds when I get home by midnight that night on any GAF fish that I catch. It's quick. It's easy. Boom. It's in. I don't have to do any of this. I mean, are we really having a lot of people cheating on here that we have to have all these names and license numbers and stuff? No, we want to know about numbers of fish. Let's make it simple. Let's make it electronic so it goes straight in the database. I know people are going to lose jobs over doing something like that. But you know something? The less money I have in my pocket is less money I feed my kids or give you guys to run the general fund. Bottom line. That is the bottom line here. And I tell you, my family has supported this state for a long, long time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Johnson, I think there's a couple more questions, but I'd like to make sure that you give my staff over here at the end of the table your name and phone number and address so that if members have some more questions, they can get a hold of you. In the interest of time, I'm trying to move things right along. We have a couple more questions. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I know there's a range of guides that make, you know, some make $10,000 a year and some make hundreds of thousands of dollars. So not everybody's rolling in the money, so I understand that. And I think it's hard to write a bill, but you want to write the bill so it doesn't go too far, right? What if we limited the Coast Guard registration requirements to just those guides and vessels that are required to have them by federal law instead of making
That's written presently.
That's how it's written presently?
Yeah, but when you get into the interior, that's a whole different ballgame. So you have a young fella who wants to take somebody out and do the freshwater deal. He's from a village, wants to do that. He's not going to get involved because everybody's going to tell him a different story, even if he wants to take somebody out fly fishing on his own corporate lands on his river. Sad. Really sad.
Through the chair, because you're telling me that the Coast Guard's not going to give somebody a straight answer whether or not they need a Coast Guard license?
No. In fact, the Coast Guard, when they come on board your vessel, can't even tell you what your requirements are. They're going off the top of their head. Promise you.
All right. Well, I don't doubt that, Mr. Chair, that could be a problem.
Why are we enforcing a Coast Guard law to begin with? Why are we even involving ourselves in that? If we've got a problem out there and we got a whole bunch of complaints of people out there running around without Coast Guard license, I sure haven't heard it. I haven't heard complaints about people not having first aid card and people keeling over one after another. I haven't heard it. I haven't seen anybody that's been sued that hasn't had insurance on the proper requirement that we're putting in a bill to have fish and game enforced. That should be Department of Commerce.
Through the chair.
One more, Representative Guerra.
I was going to ask about the book that he's got to fill out, which is a pain. But if I've only got one more, let me ask about insurance. I was trying to help him, Mr. Chair. So you've got two competing issues on insurance. One is you've got an incompetent guide out there, and, you know, in every business there are incompetent people.
Sure.
So from that sense, you do want to have insurance. On the other hand, there are guys who are making $10,000, $20,000 a year, and if you require them to have insurance, they're not going to be able to be a guide. So right. How do we sort through that? Protection of the public and protection of people to run a business.
Yeah, I look at things a little bit different, I guess, and I think in the future we're going to have to. If you've got problems out there that need to be fixed, create a law and do it. If you don't have a problem, is there anybody even come forward and said, you know, we got guys out here doing this and they don't have insurance and I got hurt and I sued them and I couldn't get any money? No. You're opening the door, actually, for the local operator, unless he's got an LLC, because the insurance requirements on the people I take, I carry $1 million. I can guarantee you they're going to go way past $1 million. I'm done anyway. So you got to be really careful with this kind of stuff. And I apologize. My mother was a good friend of Kathy's, and she always said, if you couldn't say something nice, don't say anything at all. And I'm breaking her rule here today.
Okay, we've got two more questions, then we're going to have to move on. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very, very briefly, sir, what is a chase boat and how does it operate?
Chase boat, which is now on the federal side, is not against on state side, but on federal side for halibut, a chase boat goes around and says, yells across, you catching any fish here? No. Well, follow me. Or do you want me to take some of your fish in? Or any of those numerous kind of things you can do. Canada, it's a huge, turned into a huge thing. But I can assure you, it's from what I charge per day, from what a bare boat charges per day. Okay? You're given this resource, and it's like giving oil away for 10 cents on the dollar. Would you do that? No. Why are we doing it with our fish? I'm at loss here.
So it's a follow-up. So a chase boat is employed by a bare boat's
charter? Yes, they have a person that goes around.
Provide services.
Every one of them's got it. And from what I understand on the federal rules now, they're not going to allow it to be, once a line is in the water, they can't be there.
But in essence, it's kind of an off-board, off-vessel guide.
Yes.
In essence, okay, good.
Yeah, but it really doesn't matter anymore with the new electronics with GPSs anyway. It tells you exactly where to anchor.
Okay, one more, Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I spoke to some guides in the Mat-Su, and one of the concerns that they also had was that this particular guide has an open boat, so if it's raining, he has to fill out his logbook, but he said he's got a wet logbook, and if he dares get to the shore and start cleaning the fish, he's in trouble. Right. But and that was, I guess, his biggest concern is he didn't think that, you know, what really happens is included into what the law says you've got to do. So I just wanted to compliment you that there are other folks that kind of see the silliness of it and where it just doesn't fit real life.
Yeah, the reality is on my freshwater, I have an open skiff. We run to the beach, we go up a river, and we do a lot of fly fishing. Okay, I'm supposed to fill this out before I leave the field. It's impossible. The reality is then I'm taking a gamble from leaving there going out to my boat, and I'm going to tell you that's what I do. But I get one ticket. And think of this now. In Glacier Bay, right now, for concessionaires, we have three residents, and it's the home country of Huna, community of Huna, not one person from Huna. That's how these prospectus bids are working out. You get one violation, you're done. So let's make our things reasonable. Let's be careful with strict liability when you can do that. On the guide board, we wouldn't allow the protection officers to go that far. We stopped them. And strict liability is real easy. The officer just writes you a ticket, but it goes into your file for good, just on being a day late on one of these sheets.
Mr. Johnson, I sure thank you for being here. We'll distribute your phone number. You'll be getting a few phone calls, I'm sure.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time, and I apologize for being ornery.
Thank you. And we are going to bring House Bill 41 back for public testimony and have some more statements from the sponsors, I'm sure. And is there any closing remarks from the sponsors, or do you want to wait till we bring it back? Okay. At this time, I'd like to set House Bill 41 aside. Thank you very much for the presentations. The next bill scheduled for today is House Bill 158, an act relating to a refined fuel surcharge, relating to the motor fuel tax, relating to qualified dealer license, and providing for an effective date by Representative Munoz. We do have a CS before the committee. Can I have a motion to bring the CS for HB 158 version 29 LS 0608 /E before the committee?
Chair, I move committee substitute for House Bill number 158 version 29-LS 0608 /E, Nauman 32515, for committee referral and discussion.
Okay, the CS is now before the committee. Here to present House Bill 158 today is Representative Munoz and her staff, Crystal Koneman. Please place yourselves on the record and begin your testimony on House Bill 158.
Thank you, Chairman Newman and Thompson. I appreciate the opportunity to present HB 158, members of the committee. I'd first like to start by thanking Commissioner Hartig and his staff at the Department of Environmental Conservation for their assistance in putting together this legislation. Here today is the division director for the SPAR division, Kristen Ryan, and she is available to present and answer questions as well. I'd also like to thank Senator Machicki and his staff in the Senate for their work with us on drafting the legislation. For the last 3 years, I have chaired the Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Environmental Conservation operating budget. And in each of those budget cycles, we have been informed of the situation that we would face one day with the funding shortfalls for the SPAR division, for the Oil Spill Prevention and Response Division. We knew that day was coming, and Chairman, the day has arrived. By FY17, the division will face a $7 million estimated annual shortfall, and that shortfall is expected to carry on from that point forward. Currently, the division is funded primarily through a 5-cent surcharge on oil production, on crude oil, a barrel of crude oil. And the prevention account, which funds the division, has gone down, and the balance has declined over time because it's tied to oil production, and oil production, of course, has declined. My involvement in this issue, of course, began with the chair working on the budget through the operating budget process. And at that point, when I first became aware of the problem, I introduced legislation to increase the surcharge by 2 cents to 7 cents. That was some years ago, 3 years ago. And I met a lot of resistance to increasing the surcharge. The oil industry has funded the majority of the division's activities since 1989. Yet the spills that are tied to crude oil by volume only represent about 4% of the volume of actual spills. And oil production spills account for approximately 19%. That would include processed water, diesel, and other contaminated materials. So the majority of spills are refined fuels, and they occur in the area of aviation. There are marine spills, home fuel tanks, overturned trucks, as we've read recently in the news. Just last January here in this community in Auk Bay, we had an oil spill, and the responsible party, it was difficult or impossible to determine who was responsible for the spill. Yet the spill division was the first to respond to the event and effectively contain the spill and worked very closely with the Coast Guard to prevent further environmental degradation. So most of the spill activity is occurring in non-regulated activities, and it's difficult to determine responsibility, Many of the entities, rural communities, do not have the resources to pay for the spills or to cover the costs of cleanup. So what does HB 158 do? It puts into place a surcharge on a gallon of refined fuel, 1 cent per gallon, and it would be implemented at the wholesale distribution level. We exempt international aviation fuel because of restrictions in the Commerce Clause, as well as state and federal agencies. So military is exempt. The Alaska Marine Highway System would be exempt. We use the existing system for remitting the surcharge, the existing revenue system for that's used to remit gas tax, marine tax, and aviation tax. So we're using the same form, the same computer program, et cetera. We're not requiring new staff or resources to implement this program. It's simple. It's straightforward. It will create a viable long-term funding source for the state's core oil spill prevention and response activities. Chairman, I urge your support, and I thank you for the opportunity to present the bill.
Okay. Does the committee have any questions for the sponsor? Also available to answer questions on this bill are Commissioner Larry Hartig, Department of Environmental Conservation, Ms. Christine Ryan, Director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response, DEC, Ken Alper, Director of the Tax Division, Brandon Spanos, Tax Division Deputy Director, and also we have Emily Newman, Ledge Legal is on the phone also. Questions? Representative Wilson, we'll start there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I understand this correctly, so let's say a trucking company has a spill on the Dalton Highway. This fund will now be used to clean that up versus the company.
It would depend if it's a regulated enterprise or not. Some of the business enterprises, I would imagine the trucking company is already regulated, but I think it would be helpful to have DEC, Kristen Ryan, answer directly that question.
Ms. Ryan, place yourself on the record.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Kristen Ryan, and I am the director for the Division of Spill Prevention and Response for the Department of Environmental Conservation. Representative Wilson, through the chair, every spill is different. Sometimes we have to utilize our funds, but we try not to. If we have a responsible party that we know it caused the event, they are obligated by law to pay for those cleanups. This funding covers our costs to make sure they do that, that they do clean it up to the level that would meet our standards, our state standards. If they are unable to, or we don't have a responsible party, which is Representative Munoz shared, occurs quite regularly, then we do step in and do some of the work that's necessary.
Follow up, sir?
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
Okay, so let's use Flint Hills as a different example. Okay, because we asked to actually use this fund at one time, and if the department needed to sue Flint Hills to do it versus our community having to deal with this the way they've had to, would that circumstance change if there were funds put in by these taxes?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, we are utilizing these funds to regulate Flint Hills and make sure that they are providing safe drinking water. And they are not reimbursing us for those costs at this moment. They are a responsible party, and they're obligated to reimburse us for our expenses, and it's to the tune of $2 million at this point that they have not reimbursed us. We are in court to recover those costs.
Okay, Mr.
Follow up.
I'm going to get better at asking questions if I keep trying. Okay, so I'm actually talking about the cleanup portion itself, because there's really been nothing done outside of the refinery itself for the cleanup. So, you know, if I'm off base on what this would, help me better understand what we are covering. I mean, because my understanding what the bill does is basically make all of us pay for something we didn't do. You know, because, I mean, I didn't. If I spill something like that on my property, it's my responsibility to make sure I clean it up. It's not my neighbor's responsibility. So if you can help me better understand that, you know, whether or not another incident like the Flint Hills on the cleanup itself, not, you know, bringing water to the area, that would help me.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I'll try to answer your question. We are requiring Flint Hills as a responsible party to address that issue. Have they done it to our satisfaction yet? No. I mean, that's an ongoing process, and we are continuing to work with them to make sure that they are going to do that to the level that's satisfactory. So in that situation, we have a responsible party that we're expecting to comply with our laws. But there are lots of situations where there is not a known responsible party, like the Ok Bay incident. We still have not figured out what boat caused that spill. So every situation is a little bit different. But our existing statutory authorities require us to recover costs from the responsible party and make them pay for the cleanup to meet our standards.
And what
it just doesn't always happen.
Okay. We can argue all day on whose responsibility is, because it really is to clean up our areas and then go sue whoever you need to sue, and that's not being done. But when it comes to the standards, you keep talking about DEC standards. The standards for cleanup, is that the same as what the federal government requires us to do? Is it more stringent, less stringent than they are? How does that, if the federal government were to come in versus DEC?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. So there are different degrees, different standards. Some were the same of the federal government. Some were more strict. Some they don't have any clear standards. So it varies. They don't necessarily regulate petroleum spills. That's an area where we actually have a standard and we require those to be cleaned up. They don't necessarily do so at the smaller levels. A large spill, they would step in, but at the majority of sizes of spills, they don't have a cleanup standard.
If we could get a copy of that to better understand, you know, especially when we're being become more strict than the federal government, that would be very helpful to understand what we might be getting ourselves into, and also how that is, if we're going to start cleaning up, whether that opens up the state to a lot of liability if we step into it versus someone else. Thank you.
Ms. Ryan, if you could get that to my staff, I'll get it out to the members. Next, we have Representative Sadler, then Newman, then Garrett.
Thank you, Sadler. Two questions, somewhat related, I hope. The first one, just request somebody kind of get their slide rule out to give me a conversion factor between crude oil and refined fuel. But a 1 cent per gallon fee on refined fuel is equivalent to about how many cents per gallon of crude oil?
I can tell you 1 cent on crude is about $1.4 million. And 1 cent, depending on who's exempted from this particular legislation in paying the surcharge, this legislation would generate approximately $9 million.
Just trying to get through the chair, trying to get some relative idea. If we have a 5 cent per, you know, barrel, how does that translate? How does the 1 cent per gallon translate into per barrel? So I figure someone's got a slide rule someplace to do that, but maybe we can come back with that. Second question, if I may.
Go ahead.
Looking into the bill, kind of a side issue, but on page four, question to the sponsor. What is the reason for eliminating the slightly lower fuel tax for alcohol blended fuel that is generated by woody waste or seafood waste?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, this is Crystal Keenum and staff to Representative Munoz. That language was removed both in Sections 3 and Section 4 at the request of Legislative Legal. That deals with the gasohol program, which was became obsolete June 30th, 2004. So that's technical cleanup language.
Well, this is just
that's not just that the five-year initial period is over, just that requirement for ethanol is kaput. The question is that because of the first 5 years of the facility's operation, the elimination is not because that initial five-year period has expired, correct? You're saying it's because the entire ethanol requirement has gone.
And Representative Sadler, through the chair, that's my understanding. Emily Nauman is online if there's more clarity needed on that piece.
No problem. I trust you, Ken.
Okay, next we have Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just a couple of questions. when I'm looking at the different costs, and I'm just wondering, just for clarification, there's an 8 cent a gallon motor fuel tax right now on all fuel. Mm-hmm. And then this adds additional taxes on there for the spill of the spill prevention cleanup of additional funds.
We're calling it, Mr. Chairman, a surcharge because certain entities that are exempt from the tax, the 8 cents, are included in this legislation for purposes of paying the surcharge, not including the military, state agencies, and international aviation.
Okay. Just have a couple questions, Mr. Chair. So I'm on page 2, and it repeats it again on page 3, and I'll just pick line 19. It says the tax on the surcharge on motor fuel.
It's just a term.
Okay. Your bill. On motor fuel used on watercraft of all descriptions is 5 cents a gallon. So I know most people with a boat stop by the gas station and fill up their boat. Mm-hmm. And they pay their 8 cents a gallon. So now I'm trying to figure out where's they pay an additional 5 cents, or if I would have just went to the marina, Big Lake Marina, and bought gas, is it only 5 cents a gallon there then? Or
so,
trying to understand what I'm reading here.
Mr. Chairman, the tax is not assessed at the pump. It's assessed at the distribution point, wholesale distribution. And this would be added to that point of assessment. At that point in which the 8 cents is assessed, the surcharge would also be added.
What's the difference between a sales distribution point and a pump?
Well, it's the entity that sells fuel to, yes, the wholesaler.
And if I may, Representative Newman, the difference between paying at the pump versus at the marina, you're absolutely right. You would only pay 5 cents at the marina. There is a provision in revenue statute. Probably going to get mad at me for saying this, but it's on the books that if you fill up at the pump, you can submit a claim for reimbursement for that additional 3 cents if you are using that fuel for your watercraft.
I guess that leads right into the next question, Mr. Chair.
Right ahead.
Well, it does. You know, I'm on, I guess, page 6. So,
go ahead.
Where did I read that? Somewhere in here. Page 6, section B on science 11 here, kind of starts out there. Talks about a motor fuel tax. So, the way when I read this, because if you use that motor fuel in a foreign country, so if I'm in Haines and I fill up my motorhome, and I drive to Haines Junction, as soon as I cross the border, now you have to provide a form that they can fill out and get a refund back on that gas. Is that correct?
That's beyond my expertise. I would have to ask our revenue expert to answer that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, we look at trying to reduce the amount of regulations in the state, trying to reduce the amount of state work that are done by our departments. I mean, if we don't need to be doing stuff like this, I don't know how many people actually apply for this, but this is exactly what that says. If I filled it up in Haines, mm-hmm. when I got to Haines Junction, I could turn around, and if I still had 40 gallons or 100 gallons in my fuel tank, I could submit a receipt that you're required by statute to have the paperwork for to fill out to do all this. And to get a refund on 8 cents for every gallon I did.
Representative, through the chair, if I may, and revenue is the correct department to answer this question, but this is an existing statute related to the motor fuels tax. We're not proposing to change how they're already implementing that tax, but how they handle that exact situation, I'm not sure, but I don't think that is what's occurring.
Ryan, I'm thinking about changing it.
Understand.
I mean, it's Excuse me, Mr. Chair. But I mean, I think it just makes common sense, and I don't think that the chair minds. I mean, that's just kind of a cleanup.
No, and I, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure what governing statute, federal or state, deals with that particular provision in law, but I think Ken Alper from the Revenue Department might be able to address it.
Mr. Alper, would you please come forward and give us your expert interpretation? I can't believe anybody's actually filling out the form and getting the refund to begin with. Mr. Alper, place yourself on the record, please.
Certainly, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. And to make a general clarifying comment in regard to several of Representative Newman's recent questions, we're discussing the underlying language of the existing motor fuel tax statutes, to which we are essentially appending some conforming language having to do with what would and would not would apply to this surcharge of a penny a gallon. Armed with that clarification, can Representative Newman please repeat his question about the non-highway use and the refund, so I'm sure we're all talking about the same thing.
Well, my question had to do with page 6, starting on line 7, and new language that also says, so it's not, it adds to existing statute, the entire amount of the fuel tax, or the motor fuel tax levied by a chapter, so it has to be reimbursed, somebody could reimburse for the purpose of the motor fuel tax, and the surcharge is paid on that. If you, an example could be if you drove to Haines, if I filled up your motorhome in Haines, went to Haines Junction, you could apply for a refund.
So through the chair, Representative Newman, there, this is part of a broader series of potential, I suppose, refunds where the Crystal over there mentioned the idea of the marine tax, where you, the 3 cent. There are cases where a distributor of fuel might be selling a mixed load of fuel and paying an 8 cent tax on all of it. But then depending on the end user, some of it might be going to marine use, some of it going, and there's, we have a refund program. We have a relatively active process by which people do apply for tax refunds, sometimes in the very small denominations for these incremental differences because they bought fuel on which an 8 cent tax had been paid and used it for a 5 cent tax. Yes, in theory, Representative Newman's question is correct. Someone could drive their motorhome into another country and then request a refund for that fuel that was used there. My expectation is that it's not a highly used program that exists in statute, and not to pass the buck one step further, but the chairman mentioned that online is that Brandon Spanos, he's the deputy director. He's had years of direct administration experience in our excise tax group and knows the ins and outs of how we handle these specific situations much better than I can, if you'd really like a more detailed answer.
Mr. Chair, I don't need to go that far. I'll just work with the sponsor of the bill on this, and she gets what we're talking about here. It happens to be in her bill, and I know it's existing statute, but while we got it in front of us, maybe we can fix two things here. One other question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Newman.
On page 2, in section 2, starting on page 1, it says amended by adding a new section, which reads...
What page are we on?
Page 3, or page 2, excuse me.
What line?
Well, it would be 6, 7, and 8.
Okay.
But it's a... I just mentioned it's a continuance of section 2. It starts on page 1 because it's a new section. So all this is new language. But it says fuel sold for use in a jet propulsion aircraft operated in flights to foreign countries. Prior discussions I've had on this issue with the contingency plans in Cook Inlet regarding fuel that's brought into Ted Stevens International. Fairly complex contingency plans, very complex, I'll just say that. It's my understanding that they bring almost all their fuel in now by tankers from outside of Alaska. So if we've got one of those tankers that does have a, hits an iceberg, something happens to Cook Inlet, runs into another boat, that fuel spills in there. Right now, the way this reads, fuel sold for the use in that jet propulsion aircraft, which would be that fuel in that tanker hauling it, would be exempt from any surcharge for cleanup. When this bill is about catastrophic fuel spills and being able to clean them up. Why would they be exempt?
Ms. Representative Newman, I think the intent with that language in there is for flights, say a flight originates in Japan and it stops over in, you know, at Ted Stevens International Airport, refuels, and then flies on to Iceland. Because of the Federal Commerce Clause, the intent is, you know, we can't tax that fuel. So that's the intent behind that. Now, with the tankers being brought in, you're right, that does open up another avenue, and we can look into that much more clearly.
Representative Newman, wouldn't that fall under what Emily Nauman had to say from Ledge Legal, that the owner of that vessel is going to be 100% responsible for that cleanup, and it wouldn't be coming from this fund?
It could be, but I think that's, if a foreign vessel, foreign flag vessel, comes into Ted Stevens, in line two, it already says fuel refined and used outside the United States, so that would have been fuel that's already in there. But so if they refuel at Ted Stevens International, that fuel that's brought in by a barge, something happens there. So the barge owner is responsible for that and not through anything through SPAR?
That's, Representative Newman, that's my understanding.
Okay, well, we could say, Mr. Chair, we could say the same thing about the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
That's true, too.
Why do we have SPAR then?
Excuse me, may I add something, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Alper, go right ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, what you don't see in this bill is the existing statute that defines the existing exemptions to our motor fuel tax. That's a relatively robust series of fuel types that are simply not paid. Here in Section 2 is in some ways a subset of that. I believe the decisions that were made, you know, both legally and policy-wise, were to only restrict those fuels where there might be, say, a constitutional issue. That the intent of this legislation is to apply this new surcharge on a broader world of fuel than what is currently subject to our motor fuel tax. However, somewhere between the full set of fuel and the smaller set that's currently paying the motor fuel tax, there are some exemptions that was felt we could not avoid, and those are these sort of federally constitutionally restricted issues, and that's what you see before you in Section 2 of the bill.
Something we haven't seen is a report. I haven't seen it. I'm sure there's one out there. But what has this fund been paying for? I'd like to see something that shows us what has it paid for and why weren't individuals charged and legally, if necessary, to have them refund and pay it themselves. I haven't seen any report, but maybe there's one in existence that shows where we are spending this money and why.
And then, Mr. Chair, if I could ask for some more clarification from Mr. Alper then on Section 2 with some of the issues that I brought up about that.
Okay, I've got a list of people here, and we're burning up the time. Representative Guerra, then Representative Grunberg, Guttenberg, and then Representative Pruitt. Can't even read my own writing. Representative Guerra, go right ahead.
Mr. Chair, it's two sort of conflicting comments. Number one, some bill has to pass this year. We're in trouble. We've been kicking the can down the road. Munoz has filed a bill.
A number of us have filed bills, and they haven't passed. So now we're in crisis mode. So while I don't necessarily agree with the approach of this bill, some bill has to pass, and I'm happy to lose on a vote on this just to get something passed. But a few things. Number one, the reason we have the SPAR fund, and Ms. Ryan can tell me if I'm wrong, is sometimes somebody will spill. They won't address the spill right away. We have to have a fund there to clean up right away. And then we go after the responsible party. And the state always goes after the responsible party, whether they can collect or not. The responsible party might be judgment-proof. They might flee to a foreign country, and we might not have jurisdiction over them, but they usually collect. They can talk more about that. But the reason you have the fund is you can have an immediate response. That was after the Exxon Valdez oil spill. We don't have to litigate with Exxon as to like whether and when and how they started cleaning up. We wanted to know that we could get right out there and clean up. So here are the questions I have. My personal view is it'll be more equitable to try and come closer to charging those entities and people who are causing the state to incur the costs. There's no easy way to do that, and I know that you would have done it if it was easy. But my questions relate to that. Currently, if I'm correct, 4 cents of the 5 cents per barrel surcharge on the oil companies, and frankly, that hasn't been increased in 25 years, which is a problem I have. It hasn't been inflation-proofed at all. It's the same as it was in 1989. 4 cents goes to prevention and 1 cent goes to response. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. 4 cents goes into the prevention account and 1 cent goes into the response fund until that fund hits $50 million, and then the 1 cent is suspended.
Right. Yeah. And thank you. Through the chair, I might need the department for this unless anybody else knows it, but it seems the most expensive part of the program is the spill prevention. And what we're really paying the most for is spill prevention. Spill response, we end up collecting from the responsible parties usually, and then we have that 1 cent. So on spill prevention, what are the highest categories of cost that we pay for to regulate companies to make sure they have the spill prevention plans? I mean, I know there's oil spill contingency plans that we pay for to litigate and regulate, so the big tankers have spill contingency plans, but where is that money going in rank of most cost down?
Shift.
Fine.
Representative Garrett, through the chair, thank you. Again, this is Kristen Ryan, the Director of Spill Prevention and Response. So just some clarification. We respond to a lot of spills with a prevention account. We do have the response account, which is the $50 million. That's our emergency fund for big spills. We don't tap that on a very regular basis, maybe once or twice a year. Our prevention account, which is the one that's having the funding issue, supports our entire division. It does support all the prevention work that we do, but it also pays for our response to 90% of these smaller spills that don't rise to the level to trigger the response account, which has an imminent and serious threat trigger. So I do want to make that clear on the record that this account is used for quite a bit of response work.
Through the chair.
Follow-up, Representative Garrett.
What I'm trying to find out then in this prevention account, which used for spills and prevention and oil spill contingency plans.
Yes.
Of that work, what percentage of that cost is due to regulate oil industry entities so that we can make sure they have proper oil spill contingency plans?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, in simplistic terms, you can divide the division into three units. You can divide it into our planning unit, which does all the contingency plan work. That's predominantly the oil industry, but not completely. If you count numbers of contingency plans, if you just did numbers, refined fuel products, vessels, and transit are the larger percentage of numbers. The oil contingency plans, related contingency plans, are more complicated and much more robust because the risks are higher.
That's the highest amount of dollars.
So dollar-wise, on the prevention side, I would say it's related to the oil industry. That's if you divided our division by three, so of $5 million, if you just divided $15 million three ways, you would say, you know, the largest percentage of prevention work is related to the oil industry. The second unit is our response unit, which is responding to spills. Now, that's almost predominantly refined fuel-related. By a variety of industries, including the oil industry, but also vessels and every other thing that Representative Munoz already mentioned. Our third unit is our contaminated site unit. That's the unit that's dealing with the long-term mitigation that didn't get cleaned up. And that, again, is 70% related to refined fuels by a variety of entities.
Thank you. Through the chair.
Go ahead, Ed.
I understand. So of the oil spill contingency plan work that you do, so to prevent oil spills, and every tanker, if people don't know, has an oil spill contingency plan. What portion of the money that's in the spill prevention part of your division goes to oil spill prevention contingency plans, or oil spill contingency plans, cleanup and prevention.
Representative Garrett, through the chair, if you're just restricting that activity to oil and the oil industry and exploration and production, I would, off the top of my head, roughly say 3 to 4 million.
Out of how much for
five.
The total? 3 to 4 million.
But that's just off the top of my head. I can give you more specifics.
Yep. And then through the chair, we keep talking about refined fuels, and then we're like, well, motor vehicle users use refined fuels, but it's not motor vehicle users who are spilling. I mean, of the 730,000 Alaskans, very few of them are generating the cost to the division. You're not seeing, you know, my neighbors aren't the cost to the division. So of the refined fuels, what are the kinds of businesses that cost you the most for response?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, it's highly variable depending on where the spill occurred and what they spilled, and if they have the resources to clean it up. If it's an entity we regulate, we know they already have the contract in place with a company that can go out and deal with it. But a lot of spills, that isn't the case. And we are the ones that are guiding the responsible party through that process, or we're actually doing it ourselves or hiring our own contractors to do it. So it significantly varies. I don't know if that's – if I had to give you a cost, I mean, definitely oil is the hardest thing to clean up. If we looked at the expense of responding to events, oil is the most expensive thing to pick up. But the majority of our responses are related to refined fuel. And for the record, it is your neighbor. It is all of us. It is everybody who uses fuel. Our spills are homeowners. Our spills are vessels. They're villages. They're trucks rolling over the highway. You know, we all are utilizing the fuel that's being spilled.
Through the chair.
One more, Representative Garrett.
I still would like to know, for the response, in terms of the dollars that you spend, what industries or classes of people are the most expensive for the department? Because I know it's not my neighbor my neighbor doesn't even register.
Hopefully the report that I've asked for will be giving us a lot of that information.
And if I may add, Mr. Chairman, we are required by statute already to provide a biannual report to the legislature that itemizes every expense of the fund, and you received that in January this year, and I am happy to provide copies to the committee again if they would
love it. Thank you.
How about an answer to the question, though?
Pardon?
But an answer to the question would be useful, even if it's a back-of-the-napkin answer. I'd like to know what industries or classes of users are the most expensive to the state in terms of response.
Mr. Chairman.
I assume that this report will break that down.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Munoz.
I'm going to attempt to answer the question. Of all products spilled between FY10 and 14, let's see, if I 2% are schools, 2% are vehicles, 2% are refinery operations, 3% are residents, private residents. I can't tell what the percentage is, but maintenance yards are responsible for a small percentage. Air transportation, 5%. Marine vessels, 7%. Natural gas production, 7%. Non-crude terminals, 9%. Mining operations, that would be processed water primarily, 22%.
And through the chair, Representative Guerra, there is the information in your packet that I've provided for committee members. It lists all spills for FY 10 through 14, additionally non-crude oil or refined products spilled, and then you have an overall just for FY 14. And then there is also a breakdown of contaminated sites, and that's in members' packets and available online for members of the public as well.
Through the chair, what I'm trying to find out is the dollars. This is the number of gallons, right? And what I'm trying to find is where the cost is coming from, so that you can fairly attribute the cost to those who are responsible for it. The number of gallons doesn't really help as much as the cost. And so I had seen this, but this didn't answer my question.
Rep.
So, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Ann.
We could work with the department to get a list of the most significant spills in the last calendar year and put
dollars.
A dollar figure on those, if that would be helpful.
I was hoping
to Mr. Guerra, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Representative Guerra, and I do look forward to speaking with you about your fleeing to a foreign country. Representative Grunberg. I mean, Guttenberg.
Good Lord, here I go again.
Representative Guttenberg, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Max and I look so much alike, it's hard to...
yeah. Only in Alaska would you have to flee to want to charge an extra penny on the oil industry.
So my question goes back to the Commerce Clause.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand some of the justifications for the Commerce Clause, but in this scenario, we're spreading this penny all across the state. And what about that part of international traffic that is involved in activities in state? I understand not charging somebody for fueling up at Tokyo, and not charging them here. Well, there's a percentage of what they're using is in-state, whether it's landing or taking off or passing overhead. But their activities in-state, I mean, are they completely exempt because of the Commerce Clause? And usually that is applied because somebody decides to put the entire burden on somebody that's not a citizen of the state, a state entity. But what happens is the Commerce Clause apply to those activities that are directly done in the state, or are they exempt entirely? I mean, that's the fuel trucks. That's the pickup trucks that are used for maintenance, and that's, certainly a part of the fuel. We can get into that later, but are those excluded as well?
Mr. Chairman, the activity, Representative Guttenberg, the activity that occurs in state is subject to the surcharge. The international aviation portion, the exemption applies to international flight. So any activity that's occurring in state would not be subject to an exemption of the surcharge.
Okay.
And Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, if I might, if it's federal and if there is a federal spill, I know that in my conversations with DEC, that the federal government does step up, and they are responsible for those spills. So any major money that would potentially come from the SPAR fund would be covered by the federal government.
So if I may, Mr. Chair, so a plane has an accident on the runway. Nobody's hurt. Freight mm-hmm. plane skids off in the ice. There's a spill.
Mm-hmm.
Who gets charged? The federal government or the airline?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, there are cleanup crews in international airports that would respond to those fuel spills. So the airports, as long as they're international, would cover those, and that's my understanding. And that I believe there would be some recourse in recouping those fees from the international airports to that airline.
To the airline. Okay. So they have the ability to respond regardless of anything else going on and then go after the responsible party.
And that is my understanding.
Regardless of whether they're international and not. Okay.
Representative Guttenberg, that's correct.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. We've got three more people, and we've got about 9 minutes. So Representative Pruitt, Sadler, and Kawasaki.
Okay, and I have a couple questions just to give you. One, I want to continue on that. I totally understand the leaving Alaska and flying to another country. Mm-hmm. Totally understand flying from another country to Alaska. But the FedExes, the UPSs, and all those people that stop here and then go continue on to other places within the U.S., and as I understand it, that continue from foreign countries, mm-hmm. they are also they're not going to pay for that portion that they're filling up to fly to Memphis. or to wherever they need to go. Mm-hmm. You may not have this answer, but can you, you don't have to answer it now, but can you get back to why that's the case? Because I know the domestic carriers feel that we're putting an undue burden on them. That would be the Alaska Airlines, the Deltas, those people that are just flying within the U.S., as well as your Pan Airs, your Everett's, all those that fly within. So if you can help me understand, I totally understand the rest, but why, when they're stopping here and continuing, does that exemption still seem to exist for them?
And Representative Pruitt, we will get you an answer to that. And
thank you. The second question I have, there's one after this, but the second question I have is, I'm trying to understand the provision on creating the qualified dealer license. What exactly are we doing there? What did not exist, and why are we establishing that?
For the qualified dealer?
Yeah. Which is under Section 19. It's a new provision from what I can tell.
I see Mr. Alper has an answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Ken Alper, putting myself back on the record from the Tax Division. Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, most of our taxpayers and our other tax types do have licensing provisions and statutes. Right now, our motor fuel taxpayers did not. That's a historic oversight. We have a regulatory license structure. We are simply using this bill, and I apologize for tagging onto it, as a vehicle for correcting what's more or less an inconsistency in statute and creating a statutory licensing provision for our motor fuel taxpayer base. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I want to follow up on that, because I think that's really important here is, well, we haven't heard from these dealers. We're about to create a license form, and we know that when we create licenses, there's the challenges and burdens that come from that. I mean, what exactly are we going to do different with this license than what we've been doing, that we feel that we have to do this and create this burden on these businesses?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, it's my understanding these dealers are all already licensed, but the license structure is set up in regulation. We view that to be an imperfect structure because all of our other licensees are set in statute. So my understanding is that there is no additional burden or no additional requirement with this statutory license, that it's purely a technical cleanup.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. And the last question that I have is the utilization of the money itself. We are, from what I understand in here, we have about $12 million each year, and then it's going to increase by 2% each year is the estimate in terms of what it will provide. But the question I have relates to the fact that in FY16 there's projected $7 million shortfall. This year there would be almost a $7 million shortfall, except for we have $5 million coming from the federal settlement, meaning that we'll have a $1.9 million projected shortfall. Using the FY16 numbers, the $7 million means that we'll have $5 million additional. What is the intent with the $5 million additional? And we'll start with that, and then there may be some dialogue related to that. What's the intent with the $5 million additional?
If I may start through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the fiscal note was drafted to the original version of the bill that was brought before the committee. The work draft CS, which was adopted at the beginning of this hearing, is somewhat different in some of the broader exemptions, including the international flight piece we were discussing. When we submit a revised fiscal note to the bill currently before you, it'll be more like $9.5 million per year rather than the 12. So we're talking about a smaller, I guess, excess than what was initially in your question. As for the expectation or intent of what would come of the extra money, it's all subject to legislative appropriation. Whether the legislature's will was to overfund the SPAR and let them create a fund for future shortfalls or to reappropriate that money for other general fund purposes, that would purely be at the will of the legislature.
Okay. Can I just one follow-up? Yeah, I mean, obviously our intention is that it goes into the SPAR fund, the Section 434007, which is under Section 2 there. The intent is that we plan to put it in the SPAR fund. So the question I have, though, is if we're going to continue to create a larger fund, which currently we have, And I would expect in certain years we should have situations like we have this year where we've got $5 million coming in from the federal government that will add to that fund. Is there a thought to, at a certain point, either that money is shut off or pared back like we do with the 1 cent response where once it hits $50 million, we shut that off? Is there a thought that once it gets to a certain, maybe potentially to a certain amount, that it goes into the general fund? Or I'm a little concerned with basically creating additional excess revenue for an entity that potentially, and I'm not saying that this would be the intent, but could be used as almost a slush fund because of the fact that there's additional amounts in there. And so I just want to make sure that we've got the right barriers in place to make sure that Alaskans aren't paying for a fund that has excess money. And then, of course, we're already talking about pulling other money out of their pocket other ways. I want to make sure that we're being efficient with people's money here.
Representative Munoz, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the question. So currently in the FY15, we have a shortfall of about $800,000 in the prevention account. To fund the activities of the prevention SPAR division. In FY16, you're right, there's expected a settlement on a contaminated federal site in Antioch. $5 million is expected. We're not sure if it's coming in 16 or 17. But the shortfall, if it does come in, would be $1.7 million. In the year after that, it's $7 million, the projected shortfall, and is expected to continue at approximately $7 million for several years going forward. The legislature, as you know, is subject can appropriate the amount of money that is needed to fund that shortfall. This gives us a source of revenue to provide the expected short funding to fund that amount. But if there is another settlement in the future similar to the Antioch situation, of course the legislature has the ability and the prerogative to adjust accordingly.
Yeah. And Representative Perut, if I might add, in my talks with DEC, they don't anticipate any large settlements coming in the near future. Additionally, with the decline in production, the 4 cents that we get from that is going to be going down. So until there's a turnaround in production and we can get, there's money needed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to just make it clear that there's the potential that we also could be adding to the general fund with this, and I think that's just it's an honest discussion with the public that of what we're doing here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt. This will be our final one, would be Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've actually, Representative Pruitt asked my earlier question, but I came up with another one quick to take advantage of our 30 seconds. To the sponsor, given the shortfall in the SPAR fund, why did you go to a surcharge on refined fuel as opposed to just adding on to the per barrel crude oil fee? What's your thought there?
Thank you, Mr. Through the Chair, Representative Sadler. I did try that approach 2 years ago, and we actually had an amendment when the SB 21 discussion was happening that also failed, and it was due to the argument that the oil industry was already covering the majority of the costs of the division's work, and we needed to look at a broader an opportunity to share that burden with a broader population of users.
We'll get that in the record. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I see that our time has expired, and I want to thank everybody that participated and commented on House Bill 158, and at this time I'm going to set House Bill 158 aside. The next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for Thursday, tomorrow, at 1:30 p.m. in this room. And at this meeting, we'll be hearing House Bill 101. Also, originally, we had scheduled pending referral House Senate Bill 64. We are going to cancel Senate Bill 64 until Monday. And with that, at 3:30 p.m., we are adjourned.